So this is the last of our three-part series about AI and Halacha. And I would actually add that this year is different because we sort of framed this series as the Halachos of the future and what future technology holds for Halacha. This is different in that this is not a thing of the future. It's a thing of the present. Let's give you a number. I just saw that apparently in a talk at the Uber Elevate Summit in Washington, D.C., which was about 6 months ago, the Department of Transportation Secretary stated that there were 1,400 self-driving cars currently being tested in the United States across 36 states and 80 companies. And I was talking to someone yesterday, and I told them I was getting this year, and they said, well, just that day, they had been on the highway with their friend in a Tesla car, and they just turned the car onto autopilot on the middle of the highway and drives by itself. So self-driving cars are a topic that is already very much in play as we speak. So what are the issues with self-driving cars? If you take a look at the first source, secular one, it's from Sven Nyholm. Sven Nyholm is an assistant professor of philosophy and ethics at Eindhoven University of Technology. He has a doctorate in applied ethics. And he points out as follows. So just for starters, actually, I'm curious, who here, if given the option, would buy a self-driving car? Yeah, why? Curiously.
Why?
So why would you?
You could rest.
You could rest, okay. Convenience, you know. Hey, finally get a nice nap in the car without worrying about the ramifications. Any other ideas? Do you think it's safer or less safe to drive a self-driving car?
100% safe.
Right. So these self-driving cars, when equipped with the appropriate sensors and computers, would be much safer. There would be programs to avoid some of the accidents that occur from people who are careless or are not paying attention or, you know, turn the wheel too much to one way or accelerate at too high of a speed.
So I think it would be safer when all cars are self-driving.
Ah, so this is a good point. The question is that we'll ever get to that point. And there will certainly be a period of time where it's not at that point. So all in all, self-driving cars are assumed to be a safer choice of a vehicle. However, even a self-driving car cannot account for all circumstances, right? For instance, what is her name?
Mike.
So Mike says, it'd be better if everyone had a self-driving car. Well, it's likely that won't be the case when self-driving cars are first introduced. You can't help, let's say, a careless or reckless driver who suddenly veers into the lane before the sensors of the self-driving car can react appropriately. And therefore, it is incumbent upon those who program the self-driving car to already program into the vehicle what it would do in a given situation. A situation, an extenuating circumstance where there has to be a decision made between, you know, which way to go, and either way will result in some sort of tragic accident. How should we program these vehicles? That's the question at hand today. So many in the world of ethics have suggested the trolley problem as a good standard for evaluating this question. Anybody know what the trolley problem is? So it goes as follows. I brought you in source 2 the originator of this trolley issue, Philippa Foote. She was an English philosopher, 20th century, died a few years ago. She does it a bit differently. You can take a look. But the basic, there are two basic problems. So problem number one goes like this. We'll call it the switch problem. So you're an engineer, or you are operating a railroad track, and you see a trolley going on the railroad track, and the trolley is headed for a party of five people. And if the trolley continues in the direction that it's going, it will kill those five people. Okay, so what do? Well, you have a switch. And if you pull that switch, then the trolley will be redirected toward another track. On that track, there's one person. So should you pull that switch and redirect the train toward one person rather than letting the train continue on its path and kill five people? That is one version of the trolley problem. Craig, what would you say? Any thoughts?
Deep down, I would say yes, but I know.
All right, hey, you're already making assumptions. I don't know about that, but you're saying halacha says no, but you would say yes. Why?
Because you want to have an outcome where you have fewer people dying.
Fewer people dying. Perfect. You'd rather have, most people would say that rather than let five people die, it's better to pull that switch. and make one person blind. Now, so what's the point that you're making?
You could let five people die, or you could make one person die.
Right, so activity versus inactivity. That's part of the car. The moral consideration is, how important is that? And we'll get to it later. It's referred to as deontology versus utilitarianism. So on the one hand, you could say we care about people, numbers. I want less people to die, and I will take the decision which will ensure less people die. On the other hand, the other way of looking at it is, what is right and what is wrong? Right? Evaluating the rightness and the wrongness of the action in and of itself, regardless of how many people will die. Not regardless of, but taking that into account, but that's not the only factor. So for instance, you're saying it's worse to do an active act of murder rather than to be passive, even if that passive, that inactivity will result in murder. Right? That might be a consideration. Now, most people would say that you should pull that switch. That's what's been found. There are studies of this. It's called trolleyology. There's a whole field of analyzing this issue. If you go to MIT, has a website with various different configurations of factors, and they ask everyone, what would you do? So the other version is as follows, okay? And let's say this is, instead of the switch problem, it's the footbridge problem. So now it's the same thing, but instead of being on the side of the track and you have your switch, you're on a footbridge. And you see this trolley going toward these five people. And, sorry for not being politically correct, you're there on your footbridge, and there's a overweight person who has a lot of body mass. You push that person, say for argument's sake, you push that person onto the track, he will stop the train from colliding with these people and save all five of them, right? But he will die in the process. So should you push that person onto the train? If you look in Source 2, she has it a bit differently. It's a case where you have a judge, and there's a reckless, angry mob, and they want to kill and murder a lot of people because of one particular person they think is guilty of stealing money from them. And the question the judge is dealing with is, should he hand over this person to these people and convict him or her unjustly in order to save the masses, right? And so in the second case, that's called the footbridge case, most people would say, no, you can't do that. You can't push that person off the footbridge onto the track, even though it will save more people. Why do you think that is? Any thoughts? What would be the difference between the switch and the person?
It's more direct.
More direct, okay. Anything else? So one thought would be that person is not is completely out of the line of fire. I guess you could argue about the train. But this is part of the study, which is, why is it that we think naturally? It's also gone. It's a neuroscience, how we neurologically develop our ways of thinking and our morals. Why is it that most people, in the case of the switch, will say, pull that switch, but not in the case of the footbridge? You cannot push that person. And it's been generalized. It's not just these particular questions. It's generally, one question is, can you perform an act to save many people over one person? Which methods are permitted or permissible or morally acceptable to do that? The differences between positive and negative duties, things I have to do versus things I can't do, the things that like killing versus letting die. These are all moral questions associated with this question. So the question is, well, we're going to take it from halakha perspective. What does halakha have to say about the trolley problem? That's the question. Yes?
Before we get to the actual answer, so three things jump to mind from what you
Beautiful.
Said. Three, I'll just say them quickly, and they might interweave into what we're going to cover. Number one, human intervention when someone's on the deathbed. Do we withdraw life support? Do we continue life support? Do we reduce the level? So that's an example of human intervention as opposed to actually allowing God's hand to dictate when people are born and die.
Interesting. No, so that's really interesting. I'm actually not going to cover that. Is that relevant in terms of just, is human intervention the question here? Meaning, is anyone saying we should just let things happen? Or, I'll tell you what I think that's relevant. It might be a question of double effect, which we, is part of the question here. When you do something for a noble purpose, but it has a very negative effect, how do we evaluate such an action? So taking someone off of a respirator, let's say, or intervening in your case might be that question. We're doing it for a good reason, but it has a very ignoble effect.
Second one is Jonah.
Jonah.
Throwing himself off the boat.
Okay, good.
Okay. So okay. Saving the life of others.
Ah, that is relevant. That will make people touch on.
That's another analogy.
Okay.
Third one was in my mind, but it escaped my mind. I'll let you know.
Okay, let me know. Perfect. Okay. So we're going to pretend, taking a step away from the self-driving cars for a second, we'll get back to that, and I want you to keep that in the back of your mind. We're going to pretend that it's the actual trolley problem. Okay? So scenario one is you're in the car. Hashem Lolin, which never happened, but let's say we're talking about the driver themselves. Okay? So you're the driver, and you need to figure out what you should do. Now, one question is, what about you? Right? Shouldn't the one theory be that you should do whatever it takes to save yourself? Okay? So, there is a source for this, and that relates to very well-known Gemara in Bava Metzia, Samach Ben Amarav, source number 3, and the Gemara says as follows, okay? L'chid Tanya. Shnayim Shehayim Halchem Baderech. There were two people who were traveling on the way. Very, very well-known case. V'ya echad mehen kiton shamayim. One of them had a flask of water. Im shoten shnei meitin. If they both drink the water, they will die. There is an insufficient amount of water in this flask to satisfy the needs of both people involved in the desert. V'im shosa echad mehen magil yishav. But if one of them drinks, then he or she will reach a pot civilization. They will survive. So what would you do? Not that anyone...
Split it.
You'd split it. Why?
It buys up time for both people.
That's a very important factor.
And you look for another option as the time goes on.
I'm saying you never know.
You're drinking juice from the cactuses.
Right, okay. Okay, any other thoughts? Not exactly the most fun thought experiment, right? You'd rather think of happier things, questions, and dilemmas. So the Gemara says, actually records a argument about this case. So Darish ben Patura. Ben Patura said, expounded. Mutav sheyushtu shnehem v'yamutu. It's better that they both drink and die. Va'al yira echad mehen mimatato shel chaviro. And not let either of them see the death of their friend. Right? Better, it's very altruistic, altruism. Rather than, you know, taking it for yourself and being selfish and even if it will mean that neither of you will be taken care of, split the water. Okay? That is Ben Potura's opinion. Ad shebar Rabbi Kiva v'lime, then Tzir Rabbi Kiva came. This is actually the psak, I believe. Rabbi Kiva said, v'chei achicha imach, and he brings a pasuk, right? Which is interesting. Why is it important that he brings a pasuk? Let's just get to what he says. He says, "V'chei achicha imach." It says in the Torah regarding tzedakah, actually, that your brother shall live with you. Chayecha komin l'chayecha vercha. Your life comes before the life of your friend. Right? Rabbi Kiva says, "I have a pasuk in the Torah telling you that you come before your friend's life. Your life takes precedence." Okay, and that's what Rabbi Kiva says. And this is the case of kiton shamayim, the flask of water. Drink the water. Don't split it. That is what Rabbi Kiva says. Okay, now, just taking a step back, would this be comparable to our case in the car? Let's say our unlucky, unfortunate driver is behind the wheel, and they have a decision. If they veer to one side, they will survive and kill somebody else who's completely innocent. And, you know, if no fault of their own, will be an unfortunate road victim. If they stay straight, then they will die. Okay? So what is this comparable to the Gemara in Bava Metzia? Chaim says no. Why not?
Because in both cases, the driver's life is okay. The issue is going to be the people at the other end, in the trolley problem.
Not the trolley problem. So let's say our version is you're in a car. You have a decision. If you veer off the road, you will kill someone. If not, then you will die.
And you veer off the road.
Yeah, you're saying Rabbi Kiva is telling you that you can veer off the road. Your life comes first.
Not really. I'm just in to see you could kill somebody else. Ah. That's my cousin. Right? Here I have water.
Oh, good. So my cousin, that's an important.
I'm going to drink my water. I'm not killing somebody else. He's going to die because he doesn't have water.
So you're again, this is the direct-indirect causation distinction. You're saying that by drinking water, that is not, it's even more indirect. But number one, it's indirect. I'm not directly killing them. Now, it happens to be that if a person doesn't have water, then they will die, and I'm taking away or consuming their source of water. That's fair, but I'm not directly doing it. More than that, what could you say? It's not just indirect, it's that it's not even an act of murder, you could argue, at all. Meaning, I am not, this is not murder, this is saving me. It's an act of atzala, it's an act of saving. Okay? Whereas, it's to be debated whether or not veering off the road in order to save yourself and thereby murdering someone else would be an act of murder. Now, I'm not sure about that. What is also worth noting is, how does Rabbi Akiva know that you can do this?
Because he's the pasuk.
A pasuk, right? What does that mean, though? What would that mean? Without the pasuk, he wouldn't have known that. So this is a very important meaning. Defining Rabbi Akiva's case is an important one because he has a pasuk teaching us this case. If in another case, we don't have this pasuk, if it's not applicable, then it's not obvious, it's not intuitive that your life comes first. That's what we see from this Gemara also.
Do you mean it's midrash as opposed to derabbanan? Is that
mean? What I mean is that I could have argued that logically this is the case. Logically, your life comes first, philosophically. Now, the Torah is teaching me that in this particular case that Rabbi Akiva is talking about, which is the case of Kino Shaman, that it's true that your life comes first. But the point, though, that we'll even touch on just in a minute, is he had to bring a pasuk to teach that, which means that it's not intuitive. He needed a special gzirat ha-katuv from the Torah to teach me that my life comes before the life of another, which is very noteworthy. Okay. So the question is, so one question to ask, and I think we're getting on it, is do you view this as an act of murder? When I veer off the road and veer into that very unfortunate bystander, not me, chas v'shalom, so let's say that happened. Let's say it's all robots, right? It gets very gruesome. So the robot veers off the road and hits the robot on the side of the road, okay? So is that an act of murder or is it an act of hatzalah, saving? Yeah.
Doesn't it also take effect if you do something before, when you make an act of murder? Like you put the lights on, you're flashing it down, or you have a sunroof, you put a flare up, so the person ahead of you sees something happen, so they stay away.
And you could, if you could prevent it, you should.
It's like Soleil, I know.
Right, certainly if you could prevent it, you should. The question, we're arguing for argument's sake, maybe, we're arguing that you can't. We're arguing that you have no choice, you veer off the road, he's going to die. Okay?
Like, how do you know there's a person ahead of you?
Like, I know there's a person ahead of you?
Yeah, like, you're driving, and you're like, and you said, this road is one person, this road is five. How do you know?
So, right, so you're making a very good point, which is the practicality of this, right? This is a thought experiment where we're just isolating certain factors for the purpose of deriving principles from those factors. You're saying, well, in real life, how do you know who's going to be there, or who will walk in the way, or whether they can get out of the way? These are all important factors, and I want to get back to that. But, yeah.
I wonder if there's a difference with respect to the imminence and the timing of it. Because, for example, if right now I get in the car and I drive and I'm about to get hit by a Mack truck and I veer off the road, clearly there was no intention to kill the other person. It happened in a split second. But if my car is driverless and we create the program such that the program, sort of like that TV show from the 670s with Hasselhoff, you know, the car
right.
Robotically said, kill one versus kill five, so we've actually coded the car to kill one versus five. So if it's given a fork in the road, it's programmed to kill the fewer people. That's different because that was well drawn out, thought out, measured, built, whereas me veering off the road in a split second, I didn't intend to kill anybody. I just, human reaction, I want to save my life.
So you're essentially arguing that whether or not you determine this as an act of murder or killing, let's say, if not murder, killing, depends on your intention. And you're arguing that in the case of the programmer, if I'm programming the robot actively, purposefully, to veer off the road in this situation and kill A instead of B, that is intentional. So that is a very good point. So taking a step back, one question you could say, one point you could make is that this Gemara in Bava Metzia is limited to a case of Hatzala. It's only a case in which what you're doing is fundamentally an act of saving. Maybe we cannot apply this Gemara to a case where it is an act of murder, which we'll get to in a second. Okay? So how would you determine that? So one, I didn't bring you too many sources because we have a lot to cover. But one question to ask is, this is the question of double effect, essentially. It's an Arista, it was raised by Thomas Aquinas, which is when I have an action, which, again, has, I'm doing for a good reason, a good motivation, and it has a good result, but also a very negative result, how do we evaluate that action? I am veering off the side of the road. Now, why am I doing that? Because I want to save myself. What result will it have that will kill someone? Is that an act of murder? So one way of evaluating that is what you're suggesting, which is maybe depends on your intention. If you intended when you did it to kill, meaning, and we can argue about what intention means. Intention means you know that it will happen and purposefully do it anyway, or does it mean you actually want to do it? Does it mean it's your desire to do it? But you could argue that if you intend for that negative result, even if it's not the primary reason that you're doing it, then that is by definition a purposeful act, right? You could say it's an act of murder if you meant to do it, okay? So this, just a few sources about this, we'll do them outside. So one is, there's a Gemara in Menachos, which talks about the following case. You have, again, a very, very sad case, you have a child that is sinking in a lake. And you want to save that child, or you don't want to save that child. And what you do is you take a fish net, and you throw the fish net in the lake. And lo and behold, two things come up in your net: the child and the fish. So the question is, what is the halacha in that case? Right? You intended well. The question and what was your intention? Do we follow your intention? Let's say, for argument's sake, you didn't even know that there was a baby in the water. You had no idea. You were trying to fish on Shabbat, and you throw the fish in the net in the water, and it turns out you got the baby and the fish. And the act is a beautiful act. It's wonderful. You saved the baby's life, but you didn't even intend to. So do we follow Basar Mashavazin? Do we follow your thought process? Do we say, well, ultimately you wanted a sin, and therefore you had to bring in Karban Chatat, because you were trying to fish? Or do we say no, that ultimately what you did was an act of saving? You saved the baby's life. So, believe it or not, the Rambam codifies this, and he says that you are exempt. Right? We follow your action, since ultimately what you did was you saved a baby's life. You are not liable, even if your intention was to do this act for a non-moral reason. That's interesting, number one. Another interesting case, which is a very big topic, which we're not going to fully explore, is the case of saving oneself with another person's money. It's a very big cigar. Are you allowed to? One question is, are you allowed to, if even for life is threatened, are you allowed to damage someone else's property in order to save your own life? And that is discussed amongst Rishonim. But one other discussion is, in the event that you do, do you owe them? So say a person is running away from a would-be attacker, okay? And they're running, and they're in someone else's house, and they break their property in the process. What is the halacha? Are they exempt? Right? They didn't mean they were doing it. They were in the process of saving themselves. Should we hold someone liable in that case? Okay. Now there's another factor here, which is that you are obligated to save another person with your money. Meaning, if you're in a situation where you could save someone's life, and it would require you to spend money to do so, you would be obligated to spend money to save their life. So should it follow based on that you should be, that the person who saves their own life and in the process damages your property should be exempt because you would have to do that in order to save them. So believe it or not, the Shulchan Aruch says that you are obligated. That in the attempt to save yourself, you damage someone else's property, you are obligated to pay them for that property. And it even says that the only reason that, let's say there's a third party, and the third party saves someone who is in danger, and in doing so, they break someone else's property, they're exempt, but they are not exempt fundamentally, they are exempt because we want to encourage people to save others, and if we would make them liable for the damages that they incurred in that process, then they wouldn't do it. So it's very interesting. Why is it? How do we square these two things? Why would it be that on the one hand you're obligated to spend money to save someone else. At the same time, if you yourself are in danger and you damage someone's property, you have to pay them back. So two interesting approaches, which I think reflect on this question. One is of the Shach. The Shach says that it depends on your intention. On your intention. Meaning, if we're talking about a case where you intended to break the property. Let's say even for the right reason, but the way that you had to save yourself was you purposefully broke their kalim. You purposefully broke their object in order to save yourself. Says the Shach, even though it's true generally, let's say in the case of Ones Gamor, if you're in extenuating circumstance, you have no choice other than to damage someone else's property, you won't be obligated. If you do it purposefully, if you intentionally do it, then you're chayav, then you're liable anyway. So based on that logic, you could argue, look, if you intentionally cause this effect, if you're veering off the road and you're saving yourself, but in so doing, intentionally harming this person, then even though you didn't really want to, nevertheless, it's still an act of murder. There is another perspective, which is that of the Chidushei Anshei Shem. He says it depends if it was inevitable. Okay? If what you're doing was inevitable, if there is no other way for you to save yourself other than to break this person's property, then you will be exempt. Then you'll be patur, then you won't have to pay them back. However, if there was another way, but you chose to save yourself through breaking the property of somebody else, then you will have to pay them back. So another way, again, another tool then for evaluating whether or not we follow your thought process or the negative action when you meant to do something for a good reason, but it resulted in a negative effect, is whether or not it was inevitable. Could you have avoided the negative effect?
But is there no difference between the situation where you have the time and the methodology to be able to understand it versus acting on impulse? Is there no distinction between the time?
Well, the question is, acting on impulse, do we consider that a purposeful act? That might be the question.
For a human being, we veer right, we kill somebody. If I did it in a split second versus me having planned it and deliberated over...
Right, so I think there might be a difference. If you're saying that when you do that impulsively, you didn't intend to... you didn't really have the intention to do the harm to that other person, you could argue that that's just an act of saving yourself. But there might be cases where you did, but you knew it was what you had to do to survive. Right? And again, most people won't have the intention to kill the other person, chas v'shalom, but they might know that they will kill that other person when they make this decision. And that knowledge in and of itself might be considered enough of intent to say, and again, it doesn't mean it's murder, but it might still be an act of killing. And the question is, does this dispensation, again, so taking a step back for a second, what we're saying is, in terms of your own, do you take priority in these situations? One question to ask is, we have our Gemara in Bava Metzia, which dictates that in a case of Kiton Shalmayim, Chayecha Kodmin, right, which is that your life comes first, and that you do take precedence. However, that might be limited to a case where what you're doing is defined as an act of saving. What I'm doing is taking water and saving myself. That is a perfectly moral act. It happens to be that it's the only flask of water available, and it results in a very unfortunate circumstance for the other person, but what I'm doing is saving myself, as opposed to a case where, in this case, I am not... you could argue that what I'm doing by varying the side is not just an act of atzala, it is an act of... I am killing someone. I'm doing it for a good reason, but I am killing someone, and maybe it's not the same. Okay? So that would be one evaluation to make. However, let's say, let's argue for argument's sake, that it is an act of murder. Are you allowed to murder someone to save yourself? So what's the answer to that question?
No.
Why not? Right. Right. So you have to be... You can't kill someone to save a life. It's one of the big three cardinal sins, which are you can't even violate on threat of death. You're not allowed to murder somebody to save your own life. Fine. Okay? There is a very interesting discussion here. If you look at source 5 and source number 6, between Reb Chaim Halevi, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, well-known Brisker Lamdan, and the Chazon Ish. So Reb Chaim was talking about the following. He was bothered by the fact that the Rambam seems to paskin that in certain inactive cases, you are obligated to still give up your life rather than commit a sin. He's bothered by the fact that the Rambam seems to paskin, even in the case of Gilui Arayot, incest or illicit relationships, that a woman would be obligated to give up her life, even though the Gemara indicates that women are karka olam. They are like passive by definition in the act of intercourse, and therefore the Rambam is bothered. Why would you say that they should be obligated to give up their life? Shouldn't it be shiv al taseh? And whatever Chaim ends up arguing is as follows. You can look at our source number 5. He says, "Nir dachinu kibur shashen shekatamnu." I think that the second explanation, which is where Chaim says that you even have to give up your life in a case where you're being passive. Passive murder is still murder. That's what he argues. That the point of when we say who says your blood is redder than the other person's, the conclusion isn't that therefore do nothing. The conclusion is that no matter what, ritzicha cannot be violated in any circumstance. He says, well, how do I know? From our Gemara. If you look at Sam Pezim Ralef 62a in Bab Mitziah, two people were walking on the way. And one of them had a flask of water. So, v'chulei, the whole story. He says, Rabbi Akiva had a unique limud. Source from the Torah, which teaches you that your life precedes the life of another person. Were you being inactive or active in that case? When you take the flask of water, are you actively murdering them? No, you're being inactive, you're being passive. You are doing a perfectly moral act, which passively results in the death of another person. However, you still needed a You needed the Torah to teach you that in such a case, you have the right to put yourself, the priority on yourself. You see that that's just there. Where it's Hatzala, what are you doing in that case? You are saving yourself. So that's when we say passive murder or passively causing the death of the life of another is permitted. However, says Reb Chaim, in a case where what you're doing is murder, even if it is in a passive way, even if Reb Chaim even argues someone pushes you and that causes the murder of somebody else, or even if it is a passive form of intercourse, that is still prohibited. That's what Reb Chaim argues here. So, according to Reb Chaim, even passive murder will be b'yahari v'al yavor. Okay? The Chazon Ish argues, he says that's crazy. He says it doesn't make any sense. Okay? Think about it. So let's say there was no Gzeirat HaKatuv. Okay? So you'll say, what do you have to do? You have to give the water to your friend. Well, then your friend will have the same exact obligation toward you. Right? This is the problem with this case. Because each one of you has the same b'chei achicha imach. Which is why the Rishonim say neither of you could take the flask from the other person. That would be murder. The question is, if you had the flask, do you give it up? So Chazon Ish says, the Gemara isn't saying there that, oh, if it hadn't been for the pasuk, you'd have to give up the flask to your friend, because then they'd have to give it back to you. It would be this horrific game of ping pong. And no one would drink the water.
You just mentioned your source 4 here.
Yeah, he did.
So you just mentioned it. But it says, he wouldn't be on staff for doing that either, for stealing the flask.
He calls you, he says, b'chav dini shemayim. Not rutzeach, but it's still a big sin. You can't do that. That's the point. Right? That's the big problem. So who's supposed to grab the flask? Chayach ha-goman. Which one? Are they going to have a wrestling match for the flask? The answer is that whoever has it. And he's rather have it. So the Chazon Ish actually says as follows. Okay? That what are they actually arguing about? He says, there the question is, the chayesha. If you look at the second and last line here in source number 6,
Rabbi
Meaning, Rabbi Matura says, it's both of them are going to live for a little bit. And that's the point here. Chai Shah, I think that's the point made before. They both can live for a little bit. And Rekib says, no. So, the Chazon Ish argues that essentially Reb Chaim is incorrect, and that passive murder, if you murder in a passive way, will still be that you will be able to do, or rather, or let happen, rather than give up your own life. So, another factor to think about here is, even if it is an act of murder, will a passive act of murder, if it would be that case, would a passive act of murder be also a Harig Valiavor? Right, then that is the argument between Rechaim and the Chazon Ish. Rechaim says, yes, it is, and the Chazon Ish argues on that. Okay, moving on to other cases. What about a reckless driver? Let's do this outside quickly. So let's say, you know, what about the following factor, right? So on the one hand, there's human life at stake. Everybody's life is valuable. Who says that your life is redder, your blood's redder than another person's blood? That's all well and good. But what about a case where somebody did something that was reckless? Say if a drunk driver, you're driving, you had the opportunity to save either the life of the reckless driver or somebody else's life. And if you keep going, then who's gonna get killed? Let's say it's the reckless driver. Okay? We're programming this robot. So does the fact that he was reckless make a difference? You would say, well, it's his fault. If he would have driven normally, if he would have done what most normal drivers do, then this wouldn't have happened. You can't really equate these two people. I have a chance to veer out of the way and kill a completely innocent bystander. Right? Let's say it's the trolley case. So I have a chance to, let's say someone runs on the tracks. Okay? Completely without notice, without thinking, they just run onto that train track. For no reason. So if I pull that switch, then I'm going to direct it towards somebody who was completely innocent, did nothing wrong, and that now they're going to die, even if it's less people. But these five people were all reckless. They shouldn't have been on the track in the first place. So the question is, does that make a difference? Does that matter? Any thoughts before we put sure. Sources? Yeah, you think so, yes.
They can't cause somebody else to die.
It's their fault. They're the ones causing the death.
Yeah.
I like that. That's a good argument. So believe it or not, it seems to me that... others have quoted this also, it's not only me. I got a lot of shiur, I should say, from Rabbi Yonah Reis, gave a shiur on a related topic recently. You can click the shiur on Tzomai Torah. So the one source mustered to this effect is the Mishnah Bava Kamma. So going out over it outside, the Mishnah Bava Kamma and the Gemara Bava Kamma talk about a case of, you have an animal, and the animal ate another person's property. So there's two cases. One case is the animal eats something normal, like peros, right, fruits or produce. And the other case is they eat something that's abnormal. Soot and kalim. Clothing. Okay? Now, the difference is that if an animal eats something normal, so that is the hanezek of shame. Right? One reason that you are liable for the damage that your animal causes another person is shame. That you're liable for what they eat. Okay? The other, if it's abnormal, that's a different av, hanezek, that is the av of regal, I believe. Right? That is the av of doing something abnormal. I've gotten that. No, I got the wrong way. It's the opposite, I think. Regal is kedarka. Regal is when it's normal. But shein is when, let's say, they bite. They bite someone. Or they do a gicha. They gore. Goring is abnormal. The difference is, for our purposes, that one of them, if they do something abnormal, then you will be liable, even if it is in Rashad Arabin. If your animal does something abnormal, so then even if you are in the public domain, you're still liable for that. So Gemara says as follows. So on this Mishnah, the Gemara says that you will only be liable if it is Rashad Arabin, not Rashad Arabin. Not in public domain. So I'm a Rav Akulu. My time, Kol Mishana V'achar V'shina Bo Pater. Rav says as follows. Rav says, look, it's true that generally, in a case of Rishit Harabim, if you do something abnormal, your animal ate clothing. That's abnormal. You should be liable for that even in public property. However, What was this person's property doing? Why were his clothing or vessels in public? Why did he leave his clothes in the middle of the street? He shouldn't have done that. That's not your fault. He was mishanet. He did something abnormal. Since he did something abnormal, you're not liable for that. Even when you're also doing something abnormal. Okay? That is Rav's opinion. That, and this could be a standard, that when someone does something abnormal, which is out of the normal activity that one could expect the person to do, then there is less liability toward that person and their mamon. And if you look in the next source number 8, a similar question. So, ask a Rav, Emtim Sor HaMashasa Kavo Shalaver Chayiv, Bala Kelev, Shisei Ba'atzim Potter. Okay? If you have a dog, let's say you have a dog, and someone incites that dog to damage, so if the person themselves incite the dog, even though it's your dog, then you are Potter. You're not obligated if someone makes your dog angry for some reason, then the dog bites them. That's not your fault. Why? Because Kol Mishana V'Achar V'Shina Bo Potter. So one could argue with that, and there's more to discuss about this, but you could argue if I'm driving normally, or we're programming the robot and to drive normally, and in a case where somebody does something abnormal and they put themselves in danger, then maybe then they have less, it's less of a consideration to damage them. Okay? So that would be the case of a reckless driver. The big case that we'll discuss with most of the remainder of our time is the primary case, right? Saving the life of one versus saving the life of many. How does Judaism navigate such a question? Okay? And as, if you look at the heading here, it's deontology versus utilitarianism. Question is, do we look at more the rightness of your action? Are you active? Are you passive? Are you doing something bad? Or do we focus more on saving more lives? That's what we care about. Look at the Talmud Yerushalmi. In Shulmot, Gemara says as follows. Source number 9 on the second side of the page. Tana. Again, very tragic Gemara, also pretty well known. You have a group of people that were traveling. Pagula Hengayim, non-Jews, encountered that. The Amr, they said, Tenu lanu echa mechem, v'n harogo to, v'im lav, hare anu horgim ekulchem. This is what Chaim was referring to before, right? What do they tell you? They tell you, give us one of you. Give us one Jew, and we will kill that Jew. They don't specify which one. Okay? But if you don't give us one, we're going to kill all of you. So again, we have this question. Should we give up one person, save everybody else, or do we say, no, we can't do that? It says in Gemara, Afilu kulon narogim l'mosru nefesh achas mi'Yisrael. Even if all of them will be killed, we cannot give over one Jew. That is the first pain that's Gemara. And in fact, yichdu lehen echad, you go in Shiva ben Bichri, you must roll tova yerogu. Let's say they specify one person like Sheva ben Bichri. So Sheva ben Bichri was a sinner and he was chayav mita. They want him because he did something bad. That they want him because he himself is liable. He's guilty. So then it says you must roll tova yerogu. Give him up and don't die. If they specify one person who is guilty, then give up that person.
Rabbi Yochanan doesn't care if he's guilty.
Ah, so that's the thing. Amr Shem Melakesh, who she chayav mitzah? Shem Melakesh says it has to be that he's chayav mitzah. Rabbi Yochanan Amr, Av Hushayno chayav mitzah. Even if he's not chayav mitzah, if they specify one person, then you can give them up. So we have this argument in the Yerushalmi. One opinion is, everybody will agree, they specify nobody, okay? They just say one of you, they don't give a name, then you cannot give up one person to save the lives of many. If they do specify one person, we have an argument in Yerushalmi, do we only give up the specified person that they want if that person is guilty, either way, or even if they're not, once they specify one person, then we can give them up. Okay, what are your thoughts on this argument? What's each opinion? So let's take Rabbi Yochanan. What's Rabbi Yochanan essentially saying? And why can you give up one person?
You're not choosing. So you're really just saving lives now.
Okay, good.
He's definitely going to get killed. So you're saving four lives.
So you're sort of addressing a question, which is, once you give up one, why does it make a difference? If the person's totally innocent, we already said that they specify nobody, then you can't give up that any person. If they just specify, I want one of you, they just say, I want one of you, you can't give anybody up. Now they specify one person, but that person, it might be a tzadik gamur, let's say, for argument's sake. And now Rabbi Yochanan says, give that person up. So why is it okay? You're saying because at that point, it's almost like his end is in sight, and now you could view that as non-act of mesira or murder. Interesting. Okay. Any other thoughts? So I think another way to tackle this question between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yochanan specifically is a question of rodif. Right? So we know that there's a rule that if you're pursuing the life of another person, right? Somebody, if you have a pursuer, somebody who is chasing after one person, many people, you can kill that person. Right? Habal harkos, kim hargo, there's a halacha rodif. You can kill some person A for trying to kill person B. So one way of addressing this, do we view this... Now, so that would be a question. If somebody's not purposefully doing it, right? But it happens to be that their life is putting everyone else's life at stake, is that a rodif? That would be one way of addressing this question. And you could argue, you know what I'm saying, it's his fault, essentially. Me even it's not a gomer, but he is the one causing ultimately the death of others. Could you argue, no, you can't say that because it's not his fault. He is not intentionally doing anything. He's just there. And they happen to want him. That's not rodif.
You have a guy's falling off a building and he's going to land on someone.
Right.
And if the guy that he lands on is going to die, he's going to live.
Right.
So can you just shoot him out of the air?
Right. It's not intentional. Exactly. So that's part of the question. Another related source, which is also a source related in the question of abortion, the Gemara talks about a case where you have a baby. Again, all these cases are very, very sad, and we shouldn't talk about them, but for argument's sake, just for the concepts of it, you have a baby who is endangering the life of their mother. So the halacha is that as long as they haven't emerged from the womb, you can chop them up to save the mother. You can kill them to save the mother. Now there, and rodef is invoked in that case. Ram invokes rodef. Now there, again, non-intentional. They didn't do anything wrong. It just, okay, but they're still causing potentially death of another person. So that might be one way.
There's still a difference between resicha and abortion, right?
Of course there is.
So his life is still, it's a different.
Correct. Different. Okay, very valid point. But in terms of the model of passively being a rodif, you have that model. And in this case, you're not murdering. You're giving them. You're giving it to somebody else, and it's mesira. It's not really resicha. Be that as it may, look at source number 10. The Rambam does not pass like Rabbi Yochanan. He follows the opinion of Rish Lakish that you cannot give up one person, even though they specify that's the person they want. Okay? You still cannot give up that one person. And he says even in the case of Shevet and Bichri, even in a case where the person is guilty, that they want him because he wants to be tried for murder, and he's running away from them, still, you don't, in Morlehem Ken Lechachila, you don't, even though that's halacha is, then you should give that person, we don't spread this around. Right? We don't tell this to people. If we start telling people that, oh, like, give up the person who is, you know, chayav mitzah, it might lead to bad consequences. Okay? That being said, both these sources, do we sacrifice the life of one for the lives of many? What would we say? Do we pull that switch and ensure that five people will be saved, even though it requires killing one person? The answer would be no. We cannot. You would think we cannot give up the life of one person to save the life of many. However, is this case directly comparable? So we might get back to, and the Chazanish is going to argue this, how do we view the act? What are you ultimately doing? When you give them that person, what type of act is that? Objectively, we just looked at that act in isolation. What are you doing when you give them that person? Mesira, you are doing a horrible act. You are giving up another person to their death. Now, you are doing it for a positive purpose. But it still might be defined as an act of mesira. What about when I veer to the side? Again, that goes back to the same question. If I veer to the side or I do something to save myself, which unfortunately has a negative effect, we could argue that that's not like giving up the person to the crowd of horrific Gentiles who are trying to kill him. That is like, that's an act of saving the life. That's like drinking the water in the desert, even though it has negative consequence. All right. So the Chazanish says as follows. Yesh ayim be'echad shirav. Look at source number 11. Yesh ayim be'echad shirav chitz holech laharog anashim rabim. You have an arrow which is on in its path to kill many people. V'yachol atot l'tzad echad. Right before, this is before the trolley problem. Generations before the Chazon Ish had a very similar problem. You have an arrow in the direction of many people. V'yachol echad shebetzad acher. It will only kill one person if you divert the arrow. Do we divert the arrow and save one person? Or kill one person and save many? Or can you not do that? He says, maybe we won't compare it to source number 9. Maybe it's not like the case of people who give up the unfortunate victim. The Jew that they're asking for. La Riga. The Asam HaMasir Hi Pu'ula Ach Zaria Shel HaReigas Nefesh Rupulas Zeh Lekal Tzar Sechidvim. Right? Chazon Ish is focusing it on the nature of the action that you are doing. In the case, in the Gemara there, even though it's for contention, that act in and of itself is an evil, horrific, barbaric act. What you are doing is giving up a life. Even though you have a positive intention, that being said, is still an act of Mesira. However,
but he also points out that that act is not actually saving anybody. That's what he says. You're not actually saving somebody by doing that.
Right. What you are doing is being Moser. What happens as a result is people will be saved. Meaning what actually saves people is that these horrible people, this army goes away. That's what saves them. So the act itself is directly causing death. It is indirectly saving. However, he argues, when you move the arrow away, you could argue that that is in and of itself an act of saving. You could argue it's not relevant, and though it happens to me that it kills somebody else. But Avery says, it's worse. Meaning, on the one hand, it's worse. What's the other flip side? Because although you're trying to enact batzalah, but you're directly causing the death. Because ultimately, because you divert that arrow, it will kill someone. When you hand over the person, that's not directly killing them. This horrific army is going to kill them. That's not your action. And maybe you can't compare them at all then. So the Chazon Ish is not sure. Just interestingly, if you look at source number 12 and 13, because we don't have too much time, we'll say that outside. Rav Yosef Arye Lorenz, he's a Talmud of Chaim Kanievsky. He was actually asked this question in another tragic way, relevant to the tragedy of the Twin Towers, the 9/11. So we know that there was one plane, actually. This is a discussion also in the Journal of Halachic Problems. There was one plane that, before it could take off, the hijackers, the passengers on that plane were aware of the hijackers and their plot, and we don't know exactly what happened, but the plane crashed, and it didn't get to its intended destination of Washington, D.C. The question is, had that plane taken off, would we have been allowed to shoot it down? Given that not shooting it down, there were a number of planes that took off, or had that plane actually reached it towards its destination, and we would have had the choice, and this might have actually happened, they might have made a decision. We don't really know, but the White House might have made a decision about whether or not to down this plane. What should the decision have been? So the Mishnah B'Kuvah Nevesh here is using the approach of the Chazon Ish, and where he says that it really depends on the nature of the act that you're doing. How would we view in this case? He's really very particular. He says maybe you could say that when you shoot that, let's say the missile, the rocket that downs that plane, you're not directly killing the people in the plane. Why? Because what you're doing is you're shooting the plane, and then the people, and it's not, you know, it's a very sad situation, but it's kind of crazy to think about, and then the people on the plane will fall and die, but you're not directly murdering. Maybe you could argue that. Maybe that's too much. Maybe that's too big of a statement. It's very particular. But he says, Rav Chaim Kanievsky wasn't sure what to do in this case. But he argues that that if you had a situation where there were only terrorists in the plane, but the terrorists were over, so kill the terrorists, fine, I totally agree, but the terrorists are flying over a civilian population, And by shooting the plane, the remnants of the debris from the plane will harm people below. So that you can do. Because there, that's completely causative. There, you can argue that that's not a direct ramification of your act. So he takes this chazanist to its extreme, that we're really thinking about is not just whether your act is an act of saving or killing, but even the causation of your act. Is it a direct causation? Is a negative effect really because of what you did, or is it just an after effect? Another factor. Zit Eliezer, source 13, doesn't like this chazanist. He says that the second side is much more compelling, that you can't ever do an active... you can't actively contribute to murder anyway. If you're doing something active, he says, even the case where you're driving, and now he goes to the trolley case, he says the chazanish case of the arrow is actually much more practical. If you're driving, and if you stop, then you will save others or yourself, but by stopping, you will harm the person behind you, because you can't do that. Because stopping, and the energy and the force caused by your stopping and ramming into somebody else, that is an active act of murder. That's considered masa biyadayim. That's kocho. That's your energy. And that would be prohibited. So he takes that. So you see that it's very an interesting question. It seems to be that generally the approach is that of deontology, meaning the rightness or wrongness of your action. We think about what is the correct causation. Is it an active murder or a passive murder? And so on. I want to leave you with another thought, though, and that is the question of, is this really the right question to ask? Meaning, all of these questions are cases, again, where you're directly involved, where it's your question, and you have to choose which act to do. When they program these robotic cars, it's much more global. Here, if you look at number 14, Sven Nyholm argues that there are many other considerations. Right? First of all, there are many parties involved. There's the people who are programming the car. There's the government. There's regulation. And they have to take into account not just any direct result of you versus my life versus their life, but generally... what is the welfare of people in general? So there might be a much more global perspective here, whereby we're not just asking in any given action, what should I do, but globally, what is better for the population in general? Should we prioritize lives, or should we prioritize moral actions? And it's a different type of calculation. Sven Nyholm argues that you can't really use the trolley problem to evaluate how to program these cars. It's just two different cases. He also argues that it's hard to know with direct and complete accuracy what types of people will be in the car, what is the conditions of the road. There are just so many factors. You can't really plug it in. So just an example of source number 15, very interesting case of Zilberstein, this type of thinking. He was asked, there was somebody who was suffering from infertility, and they had a baby, Baruch Hashem, and they wanted to give a donation to the hospital, and they wanted to donate to fertility. The question was, should they have to donate to a more pressing cause, a life-threatening cause, like an emergency room or something like that? And interestingly, Rechaim Kanievsky says that even though you could argue that we don't know, we might have someone who's infertile right now, but the person whose life is at risk, you know, they might not be in the emergency room, and you're making the emergency room now. But when it comes to Chai Nefesh, we don't think about that. We always try to save the most lives as possible. And then he says, but if people know that you won't do transplants, then they won't want to live in that city. And so you have to have a transplant wing. So you see that there are different considerations when we think about globally. We're not just thinking about any particular act, but we think about the greater good of society, and that might be the way to think about this issue. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Thank you.